solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Welcome to the fifth episode of Connecting the Dots. This one is about breathing life into work. We recently crossed 100 guests at the podcast, and we are pressing the pause button on getting new guests, and we are using the opportunity to take stock and reflect on some of the learnings we've had at the podcast over the last 5 odd years. For the next several weeks, each new podcast episode will be a compilation around a theme, where I try and connect the dots between various things we've learned at the podcast across the various guests. We'll do this for a period of time, and then after a few months, we'll get back to the long-term march towards adding to the library of guests at the podcast. To put it differently, we want to pause collecting the dots for a while and focus on connecting the dots. I sincerely hope that you find these compilations of value. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman. I'm based in Mumbai, and my mission is to help growth-minded individuals play to their unique potential. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a sounding board to leaders. However, I realize that my bandwidth is finite and there are only so many people I can work with at one point in time. Hopefully, this content can make a difference to a wider set of people who are keen on playing to their potential. To know more, you can visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Breathing life into work. Let's dive in. Why are we even discussing this? Given my limited experience, I feel a lot of us go through our journeys where we put our work on a pedestal, but somehow don't give adequate importance to some of the other domains. Work and life are often seen as two sides of a seesaw and often seen as a zero-sum game. I must confess, I also operated with this mindset for a long time, till a podcast conversation with the late Chandramouli Venkatesan changed my mind. Mouli has written 2 books, Catalyst and Get Better at Getting Better. He unfortunately lost his life to cancer around October 2020. Mouli changed the way I looked at the equation of work and life.
And what I've heard continuously in corporate world is the work-life conversation is a one-way street. The traffic flows from only one way, which is work to life. And the only thing we discuss is what is the impact of work on life. My belief and what I've written in Catalyst is the impact of work on life is lesser than the impact of life on work.
Say more.
Yeah. And fundamentally, let's take an anecdote. There was an anecdote of Albert Einstein, who goes on to say in his biography that he believes that he was a great physicist and a scientist because he played a lot of violin in his life. And he believes that helped him be a great physicist and scientist. It's just an anecdote on what you do in your life. But if you were to bring it down to you and me, to succeed in work, for example, you have to be a good team player. Now imagine somebody who's played a lot of team sports in their life. What we call as life. Yeah. Does it have some bearing on how they will be as a team player at work? Right? Now, this doesn't mean you can't be a good team player if you haven't played team sport. But I'm just linking and saying the stuff you do in your life has bearing on your work. And hence the question is, can you design your life? Now, all this is happening by accident. Einstein happened to be born in a family who was Western classical passion. His mother started teaching him violin at the age of 4. Now, if he had been born in some other family, maybe he would not have learned violin. Maybe you and me wouldn't have played team sports based on our construct. Yeah. So this happens by accident. What we do in our life happens by accident. Suppose we were to turn it around and were to say that I want to live my life and design my life in a certain way which enhances my probability of success at work. What would I do? Would I actively play more team sports? Yeah, it not only gives me sports and health and benefit, but it also helps me do something else.
There's a learning cycle which impacts
learning cycle. Yeah.
Language.
Would I actively choose to pursue certain hobbies? And I have a chapter on passionate striving hobbies, as I call it. Passionate and striving being the key qualifiers. And pursuing those hobbies, would it help me at work? Would I actively seek to do some kind of social missions, which improves my understanding of human behavior and people and raises my empathy and my listening, which makes me a better leader?
I love what Moli says. Rather than focusing on impact of work on life, I think we should shift our attention to how we breathe life into our work. Let me share some perspectives that I've gleaned on this front from the podcast and from my journey and from conversations with some of my coaching clients. At the outset, I must say that the frame I found extremely useful personally comes from Professor Stu Friedman of Wharton. He studied work-life integration for several decades now and is the author of the book Total Leadership. He says that we should see this as a four-piece flywheel rather than a two-piece seesaw. He speaks about focusing on four domains of life: self, work, home, and community. Very often, we speak about work and home. Those two pieces are often well understood. But Stu introduces two other dimensions which are often neglected: self and community. So I specifically asked him to expand those two.
So the community piece, just to answer your question about what is that and how is it relevant? People struggle with that. I often get questions about, well, what is community and why does that matter? Community captures kind of everything outside of you and your work and your family. So that includes your network of friends and neighbors, people in, the place where you live. But it could also include people that you are engaged with in some kind of political group or religious group.
Mm-hmm.
So that usually has some meaning for most people. It may not be the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
For some people it is. And the self, of course, is who are you as an individual, in your own private sphere, the things that matter to your physical health, your mental health, and emotional growth, and your spiritual life, which it is important to some people and not to others.
Mm-hmm.
But these aspects of our existence are, for most people, pretty important. So these four buckets, if you will, seem to capture most of our experience. And it's also simple. There's not 12 categories, there's just four. Sure. And last point about this, I ask people to define these domains of their lives in ways that make sense to them. So there's no rigid definition that I impose, but rather it's a device to help you to think about the differentiated parts of your life. And that helps you make sense of how to bring them together. In order to make sense of the whole, you've got to see what the parts are. And so sure. People make their own decisions, choices about, well, what does home mean to me? How do I define family? And the way you define it might be different than the way I define it, and et cetera. So it's useful in that way that everything about this approach is subjectively defined by the learner, the user.
Understood. And maybe just picking up on one of the things you said, Stu, talk to us about what you mean by spiritual when you talk about self. Again, different people interpret it differently. How do you see the spiritual part of self?
Well, for some people, it's formal religion, organized formal religion. But for many people, it is cultivating your soul, your sense of connection to other human beings, to to some sense of the divine in our everyday existence, the interconnectedness of all things, and the experience of feeling connected to something bigger than just you, that people have been, you know, cultivating since the dawn of time, the dawn of human time, and in very different ways, you know, in different parts of the world. But that's that piece.
I find this mental model tremendously clarifying. I love what he says in addition. He says that very often, we treat these domains as watertight compartments, thereby leading to a zero-sum approach. But if we can allow some osmosis between these and find opportunities to kill multiple birds in one stone, as they say, that would be ideal. Let me just illustrate with a small example from my life. Back in 2010, I tore a ligament around my knee while playing tennis, the arteria cruciate ligament to be precise, called the ACL. I got an arthroscopic construction done and was recovering from it. After about a year had passed, I wanted to do something to signal to myself that I'd recovered. So I registered for the 7K run in Mumbai that happens as part of the marathon. It used to be Standard Chartered Marathon in those days. Thankfully, I was able to run the 7K all right. So I said, let me train for a half marathon. So I signed up with a running group called Striders in Mumbai and trained with them. In the process, I involved some of my colleagues from Egon Zehnder and raised funds for a charity, Salaam Bombay Foundation. It turned out that I was one of their highest fundraisers that year, and their brand ambassador was the Bollywood singer Shan. So they got the high fundraisers to go to Shan's studio and record a song, just as a thank you gesture. When the day came, I took my wife, my 2-year-old daughter, and my sister, and we went to Shan's studio and recorded a couple of songs. One was the Bollywood hit, It's the Time to Disco, and the other was my daughter singing Edelweiss from Sound of Music, and me playing the guitar. Those videos that we took that day are priceless, and we'll remember them for a long, long time to come. When I reflect back, I felt that this was a case where I was able to solve for my health by running, develop some new friendships through Striders, involve my colleagues at work, make a difference to kids who were addicted to tobacco, and create some memories for my family. Stu calls these four-way wins, where we do things in a way so that we kill multiple birds with one stone. Now, not every situation lends itself to a four-way win, but I've become more deliberate to structure things in a way so that I can kill 2, 3, or 4 birds with a stone rather than one stone each, if you know what I mean. The other thing I would say is that when COVID hit, it was interesting to see people deal with the consequence of imbalance in the 4-piece flywheel. We had one group of people where there was nowhere to hide, and clearly the lack of a healthy home environment led to all kinds of consequences, including possibly separation in some cases. We had some people who'd solved the work and home but hadn't invested in self. A few months in, they were all getting drained out because they hadn't invested in their physical and mental health. We also had a different set of people who'd solved the 3 pieces, self, work and home, but were feeling a little shallow and rudderless as they had no involvement on the community side. Given there was so much pain and suffering around us, it was hard to look away and be selfish. I guess I'm oversimplifying and caricaturing when I say this, but you get the drift. Now, COVID is a black swan event, and it had a feedback loop which made some of these things very apparent. The key for us is to think about these 4 domains proactively on a steady-state basis when there's no crisis. It's worth pausing and asking yourself the question, what does the portfolio allocation of time look like for you across these 4 dimensions? And where do you see the opportunity for rebalancing and fine-tuning? In the rest of this podcast episode, I want to talk about what I've learned from some of the other elements of life and how that has made me a better version of myself and has impacted the quality of my work. Let me discuss 4 broad areas: fatherhood, marriage, philanthropy, and hobbies. By no means are they all encompassing, but hopefully it gives you food for thought as you think about breathing life into your work. Let me start with fatherhood. I'm blessed to be a father of two lovely children, a 13-year-old girl and a 9-year-old boy. I feel parenthood is the steepest learning and development curve out there for the parent. While I could go on and on, let me share 5 thoughts in this context. First and foremost, I've learned to see things in a continuum much more as a parent. I came across this phrase in my conversation with Vinita Bali, former MD of Britannia, who's had a successful global career across 5 continents. She spoke about how her childhood shaped her.
As I think about it, I think the most significant part of, thinking about things in multiple dimensions and not in a single dimension, or thinking about things systemically, I think comes from my exposure and my interest. I guess it was my exposure which led to my interest to a lot of things when one was growing up. So, you know, in school, I used to do sports. I used to do dramatics. I used to, for a long time, I was a student of Indian classical dance, which I pursued in the evening outside of school. So I was interested in doing everything, you might say. Not that I thought about it, but I was also, you know, the school selects a junior school captain and head girl and so on. So, you know, I was thrust into those roles. And those roles, in a strange way, come with their own responsibility, which seems like a lot when you're a school kid. So I think it was a combination of all of that and my exposure to the world of theater, to the world of classical music and dance, I think refined in many ways, my aesthetics or my thinking about things across a continuum, rather than, fragmenting that, this is school and this is extracurricular. In my life, everything morphed from one to another. The school finished and then we stayed back and then we did dramatics and then we played hockey. And then, so I think in its own way, that was quite formative. That was quite formative in terms of looking at issues from multiple dimensions, in terms of creating a sensitivity and sensibility, which things like, the arts. And when I talk about arts, I talk about visual arts, I talk about performing arts, I talk about theater. I think those things enable you to touch something which the rational, objective world of valuations and, NPVs and IRRs doesn't allow you to. And I think both are important. I don't want to undermine one versus the other. But I think if we can create a greater sensitivity and sensibility and a respect for the bigger environment in which businesses operate, I think it would change things a lot, and I think it would help a lot. I think we've become too unidimensional in our thinking.
I feel looking at how children move from one activity to another, piano class, to badminton class, to dance class, to school, and so on, has made it easier for me to look at being value neutral in the way I look at the things I do, whether it is learning the guitar, doing my weight training, running the podcast, or coaching leaders. There was a similar insight that came from Lloyd Reeb of the Midlife Institute. He speaks about how he moves from one activity to another without necessarily getting impressed by some of the glitzy elements of work. He speaks about how he spends time with his grandbabies.
So now I take a morning every week to be with our 2 grandbabies. One is 1 year old. She's deaf and she has hearing aids. And the other's 3 and she's diaper changing. Now, potty changing. I mean, Deepak, can you imagine how me with one little girl with hearing aids, I'm trying not to fall out. And one little girl, I'm trying to say that, now, do you need to go potty? So she doesn't have an accident. It's like, it's like watching a circus. But it's priceless. and I'm staying in it so that I get better at it, right? I don't think I'm ever going to regret that. Do you? Do you think I ever regret the time I spend with those?
Okay, absolutely.
And so I find deep satisfaction in that. And then my next hour might be with the CEO of a big company. But I'm not impressed by one over the other.
I really like this phrase from Lloyd Reeb. I'm not impressed by one over the other. I must confess that I went through a phase of life where I would give a lot of importance to a client call or a meeting and look down upon some of the elements of parenting. But of late, I've started seeing it with a value-neutral lens. An anecdote from COVID times comes to mind. Of the various job descriptions during COVID, one responsibility of mine was to clean my son's potty when he was done doing his big job. I remember a coaching conversation with the CEO over Zoom. I was deep in the conversation when I heard my son shout, "Done!" from the bathroom nearby. This was the cue for me to attend to him. I remember I told my client somebody was at the door, bought myself a couple of minutes, cleaned my son, and was right back in the zone. I think parenting has helped me see things in a continuum and not necessarily put work on a pedestal unnecessarily. The second lesson I've learned in the context of parenting goes back to my conversation with Raj Raghunathan. Raj is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin and is the author of the book, If You're So Successful, Why Aren't You Happy? When I asked him about parenting and raising happy children, he spoke about research by a lady called Baum Rind and spoke about Captain Fontrap and Maria from The Sound of Music.
So, in answering this question, I think it's useful to think about two kind of dimensions. Okay, one is the amount of love that children get, which can be taken as, you know, whether the parents really truly deeply care for the children's well-being and are willing to kind of, you know, go out of their way to help them out. For example, you know, wake up at 4 a.m. if the children have to study and make them Horlicks or Bonvita or whatever, you know, and make sure that they're getting good quality sleep at night, make good food for them, you know, all kinds of normal things that you would think of, you know, in a loving home. So you can envision this graph in your head, one dimension, the vertical dimension being amount of love that the kids get, low to high. And the other dimension is the amount of discipline that they get, right? That are there rules in the house and do they have to follow the rules? And if they're not followed, then they're disciplined, maybe through punishment and maybe through other means, right? And so, again, you can imagine low versus high, okay? And these four cells that come out have actually been named. And the researcher that does a lot of work on this is, or used to do a lot of work, maybe she's not doing anymore, is a person named Baum Rind, B-A-U-M-R-I-N-D. And so the high cell, right? High levels of love, high levels of discipline. That is called authoritative parenting, okay? High levels of discipline, low levels of love, and that's called authoritarian parenting. And you can think of Von Trapp, right? Was it Colonel Von Trapp? Whatever, you know, so from The Sound of Music.
Of course.
So he was authoritarian, right? I mean, a lot of discipline, very little love until Maria comes into the household. Okay, and the low levels of love, low levels of authority, discipline, that's called negligent parenting, where, you know, the kid is just abandoned, basically. No love, no discipline. If you have read this short story called Junius Maltby, I think that is probably negligent. Actually, maybe that is permissive, actually. You know, that's the fourth category, which is a lot of love and no discipline, okay? And what we found is that, as far as we could tell, the discipline dimension wasn't that significant at all in our study, okay? So one of the things that we worry about is that if we don't discipline our kids when they're growing up, then they're going to end up being messed up. You know, they're not going to be able to be diligent in pursuing their passions. They're not going to put in those 10,000 hours. They're not going to be successful. They're going to fritter it all away. And that's a big, deep worry that a lot of parents have. Okay. And I'm not saying that discipline is not important, but I think it's a little bit less important than we think it is. Okay. And if it comes to a compromise or a trade-off between love and discipline, I think that love should always trump. love should always trump. Okay. And sometimes what we do, and we are very good at this as human beings, is that in the garb of love, we end up passing what is actually our pet desire, right? And so, for a very stark example of this, that, you know, we want our kids to really succeed in, let's say, playing the piano, right? And we give them, like, you know, very harsh, metered harsh punishment if they end up not practicing enough, you know? We tell them that it's all for you. It's for you, but because I love you that I do this, okay? So in the art of love, we kind of end up being martinets, strict martinets that are even willing to psychologically punish our kids so that they achieve our goals. So I would say that as a parent, I think one thing you need to do is you need to kind of step back a little bit and ask yourself, well, why do I want them to achieve this goal? And really be deep, like truly honest to yourself about why, right? And I think that many parents will discover that one of the reasons why they want their kids to achieve these goals is because they themselves did not achieve these goals. Okay, so it's a kind of a vicarious way of fulfilling what happens to be your pet dream, and you want to, now that you failed in achieving it. And often it's the case that these parents themselves were probably subject to a lot of discipline without love from their parents, and at that point they reacted violently against it or passive aggressively against it, and they didn't learn to play the piano as a kid or mridangam or what have you, and now they're kind of regretting it and they wish that they had actually learned. Okay. And they kind of, you know, absorb that blame to some extent. And now they're kind of like ragging, right? I mean, you just pass it on to the next generation. Okay. And there's a much, much better approach. And the approach is got to do with love, you know? So if you truly want your kids to achieve this thing, you know, you want them to achieve, great heights in piano, then why didn't you learn it yourself right now, right? Sit down with them and practice with it rather than telling them, you know what, you go and practice.
One of the things I'm happiest about from COVID is that we as a family recorded many songs, something I'm sure I will treasure for a long time to come. I must also confess that in the past, I often defaulted to a Captain Von Trapp approach and indexed on discipline. But after speaking with Raj, I've started tuning into the Maria way of parenting. It's still a work in progress, but I'm trying. Every now and then, Captain Von Trapp emerges, but I have to work hard to keep him in check and channel my Maria. While I'm trying to apply some of these insights in the realm of parenting, I find that this insight from Raj is in line with the emerging paradigm of leadership. It's about moving from command and control to trust and inspire. Stephen M. R. Covey speaks about it here.
Command and control is more of a mechanistic mindset. So I'm a machinist, tinkering. Trust and inspire, I view myself, I'm a gardener. I'm trying to create conditions for the seeds to grow, for the people to grow. But the life and the power is in the seed. The life and the power is in the people. I'm a gardener, not a mechanic. It's an organic system. Command and control will focus on motivation, carrot and stick. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's just limited. You know, so, you know, do rewards work? Sure, they motivate people to want to get more rewards, more carrots, more sticks. But you got to constantly feed it more external stimuli. Trust and inspire, the focus is on inspiration. It's intrinsic, it's internal, it's inside of people. And whereas motivation is external, it's outside of them. Inspiration is internal, inside of them. So I light the fire within. And when that fire gets lit inside of somebody, that can burn on for months, if not years, without the need for constant new external stimuli. And so I'm really tapping into that. To inspire means to breathe life into. So I breathe life into relationships, into teams, into cultures, whereas command and control often sucks the life out of people and teams and cultures. Command and control, it's kind of compliance-based. Trust and inspire is focused on commitment. It includes compliance, but so much more, you know, because you're really tapping into what's inside of people. You can get command and control will achieve association. It's a good thing. But trust and inspire, you can really achieve a sense of belonging and inclusion. You just can go to a different level. Command and control is good to coordinate. But trust and inspire, enables you to truly collaborate among partners and teams, interconnected teams, versus mere coordination among groups or silos. You're different in kind. I can kind of go on and on and on. And you'll see there's a contrast. And I liken it less that good and, you know, bad and good, with command and control being all bad and Trust Inspire being all good. Look at it this way. Be efficient with things and effective with people. So efficiency is a good thing with things, systems, structure, strategies, processes. But the moment you try to be efficient with people, you lose effectiveness. So it's not good and bad. It's not either or, it's and. Efficient with things, effective with people. Manage things, lead people. But when we start to manage people like things and be efficient with people like things, that's too much the command and control paradigm. And I might be kind about it and thoughtful and the like, but that's just an enlightened command and control paradigm. Better than the authoritarian, which is just, you know, barking out the orders. But I'm not going to really tap into the potential, the greatness, the talent that is inside of people. We won't play to our potential, to use your phrase, you know, play the potential. We won't be playing to our potential. And it was Mahatma Gandhi who said, the difference between what we are doing and what we are capable of doing would solve most of the world's problems.
If we all could try to be Maria in the workplace, I think we could get a lot more done. The third point I want to make in the context of learning from parenting is around cheerleading. We find it so easy to be cheerleaders when our child is playing soccer or playing the piano, but find it very difficult to cheerlead our colleagues or the adults we interact with. Turns out, adults need as much cheerleading as children, and fascinatingly enough, it's quite a rare phenomenon. This came up in my conversation about Bill Campbell, often called the $1 trillion coach. There were many things that made him great. One such thing was the fact that he was a great cheerleader.
Bill would make you believe in yourself almost more than you believed in yourself. And as a manager, you know, Bill wanted managers to make their people be an evangelist for courage for their people. In the workplace, in any place, people tend to be risk averse. They don't want to fail. And so it's the manager's job to actually push people to be more daring, to be more courageous. So to become an evangelist for courage, push people to do more by making them believe they can do it. And usually they can. And, you know, so that's a lot of what we want from a coach is someone, you know, yes, we need people to tell it, correct us when we do something wrong and, you know, help us learn. But sometimes you just want someone to cheer. Say, man, you're awesome. Keep going. And so, you know, one of my favorite anecdotes from our book is we were talking to Clay Bavor. Clay is a VP here at Google. He oversees our VR and AR products, virtual reality and augmented reality products. And at the time that this story took place, Clay was a product manager, and he was just starting to work on AR products. And he was showing an early VR products. He was showing an early product to the Google board. So he was kind of nervous. He's up in front of the Google board and he's demonstrating this thing, and they're all wearing the goggles and trying them out. And he's trying to walk people through this demo, and something went well. And he hears this clap from the back of the room, like boom, 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 like loud cheering. And it's Bill Campbell cheering him on. And Clay said that moment gave him such confidence and such a boost. And think about it, how often when you're in a meeting and something goes well, or someone on your team does something well, you say, you know, like good job or something like that, of course. But how often do you like, yeah, man, stand up and clap? You don't, because it doesn't feel right. But that's what Bill would do. So that's part of being an evangelist for courage, is really cheering people and celebrating their successes. And there's an interesting sort of tactical component as well. When we were talking to one of the Apple board members, I don't recall, he talked about how Bill would do this in an Apple meeting as well. Well, Eddie Q told us about how Bill did this when he was showing the Apple board the Apple Play Store for the first time, and how Bill was like cheering and saying, this is so awesome. And it also sort of gets momentum going in the room if you want to make a decision that way. It's pretty hard to decide against or argue against something when someone has literally stood up and cheered for it. So, you know, there's a tactical aspect as well. But mostly this concept of being an evangelist for courage is just this idea of blowing confidence into people, just trying to boost them up, make them think they can do more than they think they can.
I find it fascinating that we find it easy to cheerlead our children, but often hesitate to cheerlead our colleagues in an explicit way. The fourth point I want to make in this context is related but slightly different. It's about the role of celebration in wiring a habit. I didn't quite realize that there was a link between the fist pump and building a new habit. BJ Fogg of Stanford, author of Tiny Habits, speaks about it here.
So the ABC of Tiny Habits is kind of an accident that it's ABC. That was not intentional. It just happened. Mm-hmm. But A stands for the anchor. So that's the thing you already do. It's solid and reliable in your life. The anchor then reminds you to do the new habit. So the B is the behavior. What's the tiny behavior? So brushing might be your anchor. You always brush. And let's say you don't have the habit of flossing. So flossing is what then comes right after brushing. So brushing becomes the reminder to floss. And that's how you do it in the tiny habits method. You don't put up post-its, you don't use alarms. You use an existing routine, and tiny habits, we call it an anchor, to be the reminder for the new habit. And you don't make the habit big, you make it super tiny. So if you want to floss, perhaps it's just floss one tooth. If you want to meditate, maybe it's just three breaths. So you just scale it back so tiny. And the C part stands for celebration. And that is a technique to cause a positive emotion inside yourself, an instant positive emotion. And it's that emotion that wires the habit in. So if I'm flossing one tooth, and if I go, way to go, BJ, I look in the mirror and I smile at myself, and I feel a positive emotion, what I'm doing with that emotion, with that hack, like, way to go, BJ, I am wiring that habit into my brain. So it's a new technique. It's a new way of looking at habits. It's really effective if you can find the authentic celebration and you can wire in habits very quickly by doing it. So it's not about repetition. It's about the emotion that you feel while you're doing the new behavior. That's what causes, if it's a positive emotion, that's what causes the habit to form.
I realized that I was saying good job to my child when he or she did something simple to reinforce a certain behavior. But I also noticed that I wasn't doing enough of good job to myself. The equivalent of a fist pump when a tennis player wins a point. Of late, I've started whispering to myself in the third person, "Well done, Deepak," whenever I achieve a certain mini milestone. Becoming a father has made it easier for me to celebrate myself more often. The last point I want to talk about in the context of parenting is the notion of time out. It's often seen as an action that gets the child to go to a corner and reflect on what he or she has done. I feel that if we could take enough time out ourselves, life could be much better. Venerable Tenzin Priyadarshi, a monk and author of Leaning Into Mystery, speaks about how COVID was a massive time out for humans.
You know, COVID-19 at some level is a time out that Mother Nature has given human beings. And we've been all sent to our rooms to have a think about how we're leading our lives. And I thought that's such a profound way of framing what's going on. How should we as human beings learn from COVID-19?
Again, there are two ways around it. One way is to say there's a profound learning that can happen in this. We have learned, for better or worse, to disrupt our lives. Meaning, you know, things like we took for granted around work, family, education, all that is disrupted, right? So one thing is basically to say, okay, are there any new lessons that have been learned in this thing? Let's see. Do I begin to question that, you know, the old habits or the old mechanisms by which I was operating, are they still useful? Yeah, sort of thing. And if that's the orientation, then I think our learning is going to be rich. But if the disposition is such that, oh, this was a painful experience, let's go back to the old normal. Again, old normal was no better. It was as miserable, in fact, not more miserable, but it was a familiar sense of misery. So we are comfortable with it. So that those are the things that I think you know, people need to learn from COVID-19. You know, deeply recognize the sense of interconnectedness, the sense of interdependence that a pandemic teaches you. That we don't wish to learn otherwise. The importance of a sense of solitude rather than loneliness as a as an outburst of the busy life that we live. Recognizing how important deep human engagements are, you know, rather than just being connected on social media and so on. I mean, they all have utilitarian functions, right? But these are the things that I think we need to think about, and most importantly, embracing uncertainty. You can never be fully prepared for your life.
Wow.
And that's the biggest assumption that we make.
COVID is an extreme situation where we had an opportunity to pause and reflect and take a time out. The question is, how often do we do that as we go about our daily lives? Just to recap this piece, I feel becoming a father has helped me see things in a continuum, has got me thinking about being Maria more and more often, got me to be mindful of celebrating and cheerleading myself and the other adults I interact with, and it's also got me to apply time out to myself more often than I had in the past. Let's move to being a husband and how that's made me a better person and how it links to the world of work. Now, as the other husbands might attest, this piece itself could be a 10-hour episode. But let me pick three things that stand out for me just in the interest of time. If I look at my coaching work with leaders and force rank the development themes that come up again and again, three themes stand out. The first one would be about giving feedback in a constructive way. I notice that this is not something that's taught in a lot of places and is often left to chance. It's possibly the single biggest element that contributes to leadership development. The second would be about responding and not reacting. I find that this comes in the way of building trusted relationships, quality of judgment, and motivation levels in the team. The third and the final one would be about the notion of disagree yet commit. Most type A people who have an accelerated track for the first 15-20 years often struggle with disagreeing and committing to someone or to an idea. Now, you might be wondering, what's the link between these three things with being a husband? Here's my submission to you. Each leadership behavior needs you to practice it repeatedly till it becomes second nature. And my observation is that there's no better setting than at home to really do some practice when it comes to these behaviors and to really turn some of these things into muscle memory. I find that two things are required when we're trying to bake in a new behavior. One, high frequency of opportunities when you can practice the behavior. And two, accurate and timely feedback from someone who's critical but cares for you. Let me expand. Let's take an example of tennis. Let's say you want to improve your forehand. You will probably have your trainer throw 50 balls at you like a drill and get you to work on your forehand. That frequency helps in building muscle memory, and after every ball, the trainer is likely to give you microfeedback about your grip, leg movement, swing, timing, or something along those lines. When I think about it, I find that there are two elements about the relationship with a spouse. I believe the situation at home provides that high-frequency opportunity to turn an activity into muscle memory. The second challenge in changing behavior in the work context is helpful, timely, and accurate feedback from a loving critic. In the field of work, there's always the awkwardness and the asymmetry of power which comes in the way of accurate and timely feedback. For these two reasons, I find using home as a developmental playground a worthwhile approach. Let's take these one at a time. let's start with a point around giving meaningful feedback. One of the best pieces of insight I've heard in this context is from David Bradford, an individual who's been teaching interpersonal dynamics for more than 4 decades at Stanford. He uses the term crossing the net. I wish I had come across this sooner.
Yeah, we start with the assumption, in fact, we say this in the book, Carol and I believe you can say almost anything to almost anybody if you stick with your reality. Mm-hmm. In fact, we add, after 2 glasses of wine, we drop the almost, because we sort of in our heart of hearts think you can say anything to anybody if you stick with your reality. But being academics, we sort of cover ourselves. So what do we mean by 3 realities? In interacting, I only know 2 realities, and you know 2 realities. So let's take you and me. Reality number 1 is my motives, intentions, which leads to my behavior. Reality number 2, my words, my nonverbals, my tone, etc. The 3rd reality is the impact on you. How does it affect you? So the model is similar to the McKinsey model, but we, I think, elaborate a little differently. And what we say is, I know 2 realities, my motives, and I can see the behavior. You know 2 realities, you can see the behavior, and you know the effect on you. But you don't know my motives, and I don't know the impact. But I need to know the impact if I'm to be effective. So we then envision we actually envision 2 tennis nets, but I'm going to talk about 1.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is between my intentions, motives, and intentions, and my behavior. The second net is between behavior and your effect. But let me focus on the first.
Mm-hmm.
As in tennis, you can't play the other person's backcourt. We often get into trouble so frequently, and conflict gets worse because you, the recipient of my behavior, don't stay on your side of the court. So think of how much of what feedback is so commonly used in organizations. We say to somebody else, well, you just don't want to be a team player. You just want to push your own area. You don't care about me or my area. You just want to dominate. Well, you're over the net because you're making statements about my motives and intentions that you don't know. It's a story you're making up.
Hmm.
And so when we say, stick with your reality, you can say anything. Let's imagine that you're now feeling a little tuned out, because you're experiencing me as giving you more information than you want. So if you were to say, well, David, you just want to show how smart you are, I'm going to get defensive. But the other problem with that is I can just say, no, I don't.
Hmm.
And it has little impact. But if you stick with your reality and you say, David, I'm feeling bothered and I'm feeling a little tuned out, because I'm experiencing you as going on and on and talking too much.
Hmm.
Now, I can't say, no, you don't, or I'm over your net. No, I'm likely to say, well, I'm sorry. That's not my intention. I'm trying to be helpful. And you can say, well, I'm glad you're trying to be helpful. And I'd like you to be helpful, but the way you're now acting isn't helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And now we could have a conversation of how I can be helpful. And so much of conflict is accusations, making up these stories, and people not sticking with what they know, which is, this is how I feel. This is how your behavior is impacting me.
Mm.
And this is how it's interfering with our relationship.
And staying with that... If I may, David, and staying with that tennis rally that you just sort of outlined, you sort of spoke about staying on the same side of the net.
Right.
and what would be crossing the net. Is there something around the how we come across the emotional state, the regulation, the listening? Can you sort of paint a little bit of context around the manner in which we frame these, responses?
Well, the better the relationship, the more experience we can have. But I think that I don't have to be super careful or pussyfoot around it in the States. So I'm not experiencing this, so I'm going to make this up, Deepak, so please. So I think if you did some stuff that bothered me, I think I could say, hey, Deepak, come on. I'm really feeling bothered about what you're doing. And it's getting in the way of this interview. I think I could be forceful like that. I'm talking about myself. I am bothered. And it's hurting me. And assuming you're concerned about the relationship, it's hurting you too. That's very different than me attacking you or making suppositions about your motives or intentions.
Got it.
So, and I want to stress this because you don't have to be so careful and so nice, particularly if my concern is for you as well as me and for the relationship. You know, I'm really, something getting in the way of us working together. I can say that with a lot of joy. Hey, I'm really upset about what's going on. And you're going to say, well, what is it? If I could stick with the behavior and how it's impacting. Now, I want to come back to the whole notion of self-disclosure. One of the ways we tend to protect ourselves is not to let ourselves be vulnerable. Now, we have to be careful about vulnerability. But if we are interacting, it often helps if I'm feeling hurt or if I'm feeling put down or if I'm feeling envious to say it. If I could say, hey, Deepak, I really felt hurt by that. Now, the worst thing you could say, which I don't think you would, is, well, that's your problem, David. And I would say, no, I say that doesn't help me. Hurts a little bit more, but it hurts both of us. It's not just my problem. This is a consequence. And you see how honest a conversation we could have this way if we each stick with our reality.
Just being mindful of this one thing has made a disproportionate impact for me personally. Not to say I've figured this out. It is work in progress. But I've tried to get more mindful of this. When I look around, I find that most of the issues often can be traced back to one or both crossing the net. The next one is about responding and not reacting. This is another theme that comes up time and time again with the leaders I work with. They end up acting in the spur of the moment and don't pause and choose a response. Rich Fernandez, CEO of Search Inside Yourself, which was incubated in Google, uses the term response flexibility in this context.
Emotional resilience happens when you're able to become aware of the emotions that you're having as you're having them. This has a little bit more to do with open monitoring that I was discussing earlier. You're noticing what's arising within you as an emotion, as it's arising in real time. And it allows you then to take that distance that I was talking about, to exercise that response flexibility, right? When you're aware of your emotions, you're able to manage them. When you're aware of your emotions, you're able to respond rather than react. Now, some listeners might say, well, look, Rich, it's really important to react. I'm in a business where I have to react. And I would say to you, unless you're experiencing an existential threat, like your life is in jeopardy, it's going to always be far more effective to respond rather than react. Because responding doesn't mean going slow.
True.
think of, so let me give you an example to make this really concrete and really, really clear. Have you ever been in an airplane and experienced heavy turbulence?
Absolutely.
You have, right? I'm sure the listeners have too, right? Who do you want in the cockpit in that moment? Somebody who's reacting and just alarmed and on fire, or someone who's calm, competent, clear-headed, and knows exactly what needs to happen and when it needs to happen?
Hmm.
Right?
Captain Sully, yeah.
Yes, you want Captain Sully Sullenberg. I've actually met the man. He came to give a talk at Google, and he is that way when you meet him. He is like one of the calmest, most grounded people I know. But what does he say, actually? He says that he trained, and this is, by the way, for the listeners who aren't familiar with Captain Sully Sullenberger, he's the man who landed the jet plane that was flying over New York City. It flew through a flock of geese, so they lost all jet propulsion because the geese flew into the engine and burnt them out. So in the space, I think, of about 3 minutes, he had to make a split-second decision to land the airplane on the Hudson River. It was the only available large open space over New York City. But he thought about this very, very calmly.
Now, luckily, most of us don't have to deal with the kind of stress that Captain Sully Sullenberger had to deal with. I'll tell you where I had an opportunity to work on this. This was during COVID, and because of Zoom, things were getting scheduled back to back to back. As a result of that, what was happening was that I was getting triggered and my frustrations in one place would show up in a different place, a phenomenon often known as psychological spillover. But working on some mindfulness techniques, coupled with some breathing spaces in the calendar, slowly helped me move in the direction of responding and not reacting. I also realized that this had a direct connect with my hunger levels and sleep levels, going back to listening to your body. Whenever I got irritable, my wife would quickly bring my attention to one of these factors and I would correct myself. Once again, work in progress, but the high frequency coupled with timely feedback was valuable in me covering some ground here. As you grow senior in your roles and your blast radius increases, you can create a lot of collateral damage by reacting and not responding in a situation. It's one of those things with very little upside, but potentially a lot of downside. The third theme is disagree yet commit. It's a development issue that a lot of type A leaders have. They have trouble letting go, and they have the tendency to do an I told you so. Marshall Goldsmith, the author of the book What Got You Here Won't Get You There, speaks about 20 things that can derail people once they get to the top. One of them is trying to win too much. This is directly connected with disagreeing but not committing. The home context provides so many avenues where there's a difference of opinion, the decision is taken the other way, and then you need to play along. Whether it's where to eat, where to vacation, which classes should we send the child to, which movie shall we watch, and so on. I find that working on this has also been incredibly helpful in me covering some ground here. As I had mentioned, there could be multiple areas where the spousal relationship can help from a developmental standpoint, but in my empirical observation, these three stand out. Not crossing the net, responding and not reacting, disagreeing yet committing. Let's now shift our attention to the community piece that Stu Friedman refers to in the four-piece flywheel. I have been involved with Social Venture Partners, a group of philanthropists who pool in a sum of money, deploy it in a few chosen organizations, and then assemble teams to help these organizations in some of the areas where they might need help. In that context, I started my journey with Antarang Foundation. I was part of the team from Social Venture Partners that was allocated to Antarang, headed by Priya Agarwal. As I engaged with them, I got a chance to interact with several youngsters who were really bright and talented, but possibly just unlucky being born in a family without adequate means or connects. Warren Buffett calls it the ovarian lottery. I also discovered how tough it was to drive change in the social sector. Ashish Dhawan, one of the most successful PE investors, now the founder at Central Square Foundation, describes it beautifully.
You know, as corporate people, particularly, I had about 20 years of investing under my belt. I looked at lots of companies, a lot of industries. There's a little bit of this naive assumption that I can figure out this one pretty quickly. I'll read some stuff, I'll talk to some people, and I'll be able to synthesize it and come up with something different and put it out there that this is what needs to get done. And almost be able to start preaching to folks quickly. And, you know, I think the social sector, the production function is very complex. I mean, the number of stakeholders you have, including the involvement of the government, the layers through which the whole education process gets transacted. You need an understanding of many things before you actually can make these comments. You need to read the evidence, the literature, which is more in the academic world. You need to understand sort of the content, which is curriculum, and look at curricular experts and instructional design. You need to understand pedagogy and how that works. You need to understand the system. How does government work? You need to understand money, what role the budgets play, and things like that. And then, you know, over time, and understand the data, what data is out there, what's valid, what's not, and understand, you know, how does this system change actually work? Because it's a very complex function. To improve India's education system in one state, say Maharashtra, I think is much more complicated than running TCS, for instance. By the way, it's almost similar number of employees, in about 500,000 in each of those. But I think it's far more complicated to figure out how. And it would be naive. I mean, it's naive to come in with 2 months of understanding and try to go to the CEO of TCS and say, here's how you should run your company. It would be doubly naive to do that, you know, with the actors in education.
And what drives that delta complexity?
I think it's the fact that there are so many. One is it's a very complex production function. You know, how you educate a child is very complicated. I mean, there are home effects, and so you have to look at how you can improve home effects and what role the parent is going to play. We don't think about it in our homes because we sort of naturally, most of us, play that role. But with a low income, less literate parent who has many other demands of their time, dealing with the vagaries, vicissitudes of life, you know, what role should they play? What is positive parenting? How should they get involved with the education? Hmm. You know, it is very, very complicated in figuring that out. How do you motivate a frontline government employee, change their belief system? How do you motivate them? There are 500,000 of them in Maharashtra, right? Teachers. And what tools do you give them to succeed? You have data in the system, and there's a natural tendency to inflate the data. It's a public system. Hmm. How do you truth score admin data and improve it? You know, so that systemically you have better data coming out, make the assessments more low stake. How do you get people to start using data in this very complex system? You know, how do you get the middle management sort of retooled so it can play an important role in actually coaching, providing feedback, collecting more authentic data from what it's doing today? So that whole change management, you know, how do you do it within a public system? How do you get the political commitment? Because till you don't have the chief minister of a state behind it, you know, bureaucrats will keep changing. And, you know, you work for 2 years and then your work will be done. And how do you get not only the political commitment from the top, but deeper commitment? How do you get the top 400-500 people to sort of buy in and want the reform? So system change, I think, in the public system is much harder because you don't have the levers of control that you have. And neither do you have the capacity. You don't have a large HR department in the Maharashtra school system, right, to tell you how you're going to do motivate employees and what tools you're going to provide them. You're sort of flying with a different sort of system of middle management, et cetera. So I think changing government and improving systems is hard because there is much greater inertia. The incentives are very, very different. And I think figuring that out is a big challenge if you've come from the corporate world where you're used to having the levers of control. The joystick is in your hand. And, you know, you come in naturally with all guns blazing with ideas. You also have a tendency to want to move quickly and, you know, have this. I mean, I remember coming in. And so I think one big mistake people who transition is, my advice would be sort of read a lot, listen, sparingly give advice in the first year, okay? Be more in learning mode and look to unlearn certain things and learn lots of new things because it's so complex. You need to really spend a lot of time deeply understanding it before you can jump to conclusions. A second one, I think, would be you need a different sort of degree of humility, I think, working in the social sector. I think one is, you know, when you're selling a product to an individual, of course, you need to understand the customer. But here with the sort of beneficiary, I think you really need to go a little bit deeper to understand the beneficiary, what goes on in their home. And you're not just selling them a product. You're trying to change their life or their child's life. So I think having that empathy, but also being able to deal with a variety of different people. Most people in the NGO sector are not corporate types. They're not driven by money. They're here on a mission. They think a little bit differently. And I think attuning yourself to being able to work with them, I think it's critical. I think if one wears too much of that corporate badge or too much corporate lingo, you know, upfront, you piss off a lot of people. I think so learning how to deal with the sector, I think is very, and respecting some of the people. I mean, these are people who've given up. They also went to IIM. They've given up, you know, 20 years of making money to do what they do. They're smart. They've learned a lot. I mean, they may think differently. They may behave differently. They may not have certain parts of the management toolkit you do. But for a moment, you know, learn how to build an empathetic relationship with them and see the positives that they have versus starting to question what they don't have in their toolkit.
My experience with Antarang has taught me humility. It has got me to appreciate the complexity of driving change. It has also got me to believe that while availability of opportunity might be skewed depending on where you're born, intrinsic potential is often uniformly distributed. I love what Stephen M. R. Covey says in this context of looking for potential.
Yeah, we're looking for manifestations, even if it's small, of some talent, of some skill, of some gift, of some expertise. It's like Lin-Manuel Miranda, who created Hamilton, you know, and is also a playwright. It has written music for Moana and other things. Great talent. When he was in eighth grade, he had an English teacher, and he's supposed to turn in his homework. And instead of turning in his homework that was assigned, he turned in a musical that he wrote. Mm-hmm. And the teacher, it was Dr. Herbert Rembert, he could have just said, hey, this is not the assignment. You know, I asked for this assignment, and you turn in this, what is this? Instead, here's what he said to him. He said, wow. This is amazing. You could be good at this. And it's time you stop hibernating in my class and you have a talent and a gift. See, he didn't. In other words, you're looking for talents. You're looking for gifts. It may be that you got the person, your direct report, they might be in the wrong seat on the bus, to use the Jim Collins metaphor. Maybe they have a talent that would be better used somewhere else. But you're looking for gifts, talents, insights, expertise inside of them. It may not always be immediately manifest. It may be dormant. And sometimes you don't know about that until you maybe give them a little opportunity to show something. So it's a little bit of an iterative process of you see the potential and maybe when you start to give them an opportunity to show to do something, to show something. And if they never get an opportunity, you maybe will never see it. And so see it as an iterative process. See, communicate, develop, unleash, give them an opportunity. And then maybe they show something. And I say, oh, I saw I saw a glimpse. I'll bet there's more there. And then if you begin to treat people according to their potential, not just their behavior, you'll tend to move them towards their potential. And so you treat them that way too. So again, I think it's an iterative process, but you got to look for it. Again, Emerson, no, Thoreau, it's not what you look at, it's what you see. So, you know, you're looking for this so that you can begin to see it and help them come to see it. That glimpse, that gift, that talent, that skill, that expertise.
When I was looking for editors for the Play to Potential podcast, I decided to put my money where my mouth is. Instead of going after people who had prior experience in editing podcasts, I decided to bet on hunger and intrinsic potential. The two people who work with me today, Akash and Arman, have no prior background in editing, but bring the hunger and the growth mindset, and have been able to learn and adapt. Akash used to sell credit cards online and sell tickets at the Andheri metro station. Arman used to be a barista at Starbucks. The two of them now edit all the podcasts, create the visuals, and drive a lot of the marketing around the podcast. The best insight on helping people play to potential, I find, comes from Bollywood, from the movie Deewar, starring Amitabh Bachchan. When he's a young kid, he polishes shoes, and one day a customer throws change at him. He asks the guy to hand the money in his hands, stating in Hindi, "Main kisi ke pheke hue paise nahi uthata." Basically saying, "I don't accept money that's thrown at me." To which the observer says, "Ye lambi race ka ghoda hai. Jis din zindagi ki race mein isne speed pakad li, ye sabko peeche chhod jayega." The loose translation is that this is a kid with potential, and this is a horse that will win the long game once he hits escape velocity. The way I translate it for myself is that my role is to enable some of these people hit escape velocity and do whatever it takes for them to get there. Net-net, back to what Stu Friedman says, engaging on the community piece with social venture partners, Antarang Foundation, and with Akash and Arman keeps me honest to the mission of enabling people play to their potential. The last piece I want to talk about is the one on self. I feel some of the hobbies I've pursued have helped me get better at the work I do. The first is running. There are just so many lessons I've learned from running. It has taught me to embrace my uniqueness and for me to compete with myself like nothing else has. The other big thing I've realized from running is that it teaches you the importance of getting the pace right. When I was training for half marathons, I would try and do them around 2 hours and around 2:15. I would notice that if by chance I followed a different pacer, I'd be huffing and puffing a few kilometers down the line. It has taught me to keep a very close eye on the pace of life. People talk about running a marathon, but nobody speaks about running it at a marathoner's pace. Pursuing running has helped me proactively bring my attention to the pace of the various elements of my life and to course correct if required. It has made me slow down and watch my plate to see if it's spilling over at any point in time. The second hobby that's taught me a lot on the work front is learning the guitar. I've been learning over the last several years. Just staying with it over the years has taught me patience and a greater appreciation of the long road towards learning and mastering something. I'm nowhere there yet, but at least I appreciate how steep that journey is. But the other area where I feel I've gained from learning the guitar is in the context of bringing my heart into the equation. A lot of my education and my professional background has largely been around operating with the head. But when I sing songs with the guitar, I find that it really engages my heart. That's one thing I observe with a lot of leaders I work with, especially in India. We are taught to use the head quite a bit, but we are not taught to nourish the heart and experience awe. Raj Raghunathan, author of If You're So Smart, Why Aren't You Happy, speaks about the role of awe and involving the heart and the link with happiness.
always an emotion that we feel when we are confronted with something that is far grander than ourselves, right? And usually you would imagine that encountering something like that makes us feel little and belittled, and we end up being humiliated or insulted, or, you know, feeling like we are not powerful, not very positive. But in fact, you know, being in front of, I don't know, El Capitan, right, at Yosemite. By the way, I mean, I just saw this movie called Free Solo a couple of days back. I highly recommend it for those who haven't watched it. So, or in front of the Grand Canyon, or, you know, in front of the Himalayas, the mountains, rivers, things like that, or the galaxy, you know, we're just watching the Milky Way nice night, inspires you with this feeling of smallness. And somewhat kind of paradoxically, that smallness is actually a good feeling. And it makes you feel that, you know what, I think what it does is it makes you feel that life has existed. There are so many things beyond my control. There's so many big, beautiful things. You know, why am I worrying about things that are going on in my life and getting really stressed out and worked up about it? You know, I'm going to be gone in 80, 100 years, and let me just have a good time in the meanwhile. You know, so it kind of induces the sense of time abundance or time affluence in the short run. It's not a permanent change, obviously, okay? But I think that it is a very useful hack. So whenever you're feeling really stressed out, I think it might be a good idea to kind of, you know, take a look at one of the, nowadays we have, you know, things on YouTube, right? So just look at a size of the Earth compared to the universe. So just Google something like that. And it definitely works for me. You know, it induces a sense of time affluence.
For a lot of us living in cities, nature is hard to come by. For me, listening to good quality music gives me a sense of awe. This is a question I often ask my coaching clients. What do you pursue that nourishes your heart and gives you a sense of awe? For me, music, both playing and listening to high quality music, give me a sense of awe. That, over time, I feel has helped me to bring my heart into the work I do. Finally, I want to talk about ball juggling. I learned juggling when I was living in London, around 2000, more than two decades back. I used to go to Covent Garden and experience awe by looking at all these performers. For some random reason, I thought it would be interesting to pick up juggling when I saw a juggler on a unicycle juggling knives. I decided to go and speak to one of the performers there, and he in turn invited me to his shop called Oddballs in Camden Town. I would go there every weekend, and he would give me some lessons on the side while some of his customers waited. It was quite a sight. Told me how passionate he was about teaching juggling as compared to selling juggling equipment. I would go back home, practice sincerely, and come back next week to brush up and build on the previous lesson. Long story short, over a period of 6 to 12 months, I learned several 3-ball tricks and even some 4-ball tricks. The challenge with juggling is that each trick is like learning cycling afresh. You keep falling till one day you're riding the cycle. Juggling is a bit like that. Each new trick is a 0-to-1 journey. It taught me great patience and perseverance and got me to persist even when the friction was high. Whenever I struggle to learn something new, I go back to my days of learning juggling, and that gives me the confidence that I can climb this new 0-to-1 mountain. When I came back to India, I decided to make a CD for kids and create a video titled Juggling 101 so that children could take advantage of some of the benefits of juggling: hand-eye coordination, focus, resilience, and so on. Several years later, when I was evaluating what I should do in the form of content creation, I felt I had a passion for multimedia. Given my experiences with making the juggling CD and a desire to decode lessons for the benefit of others, I subsequently uploaded this on YouTube. Just for kicks, you can type juggling 101 and my name and you will find 3 clips which have all the lessons for learning juggling. Needless to say, I had a lot more hair and the production value is so-so, but it'll give you an idea of what I was up to 20 years back. In a way, that experience gave me the conviction that I would enjoy creating content of some sort, where I decode lessons and make it accessible to others. In a way, that experience, I would say, was the genesis for the Play to Potential podcast. The limited point I'm trying to make here is that sometimes our passions hold the key to what we could become in ways that we cannot imagine. Just as we wrap up this episode of Connecting the Dots, I encourage you not to put work on a pedestal and the other elements of life subservient to it. As a matter of fact, if we are intentional, I truly believe that some of our experiences in our homes, in the communities we serve, and the hobbies we pursue can make us truly exceptional in the work we do in our offices. I can say from my lived experience that I wouldn't have it any other way. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. Thank you for tuning into the fifth episode of Connecting the Dots around breathing life into work. If you want more, you can go to the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com and tune into the various nuggets under the playlist Work and Life. If you like this format of Connecting the Dots, you might like the last few episodes we published. The first couple were on self-awareness, the third was on listening, the fourth was on identity. You can also tune into the content from the various guests of the podcast by going to playtopotential.com and then going to the guest section. Do let me know if you have any feedback on the format, anything you want me to do more of, less of, or differently. That would be really, really valuable for me and my team. If you think it is relevant, do consider sharing this episode with your friends, batchmates, colleagues, or anyone else who might be grappling with this notion of driving harmony between work and life. Thank you for listening and for your attention. Do also consider rating and reviewing us at Apple or Spotify or wherever else you consume this content. It would really mean a lot for us to keep raising the bar on what we do. We also have a WhatsApp group where we share one or two pieces of content a week. While we run the Connecting the Dots series, we'll be sharing nuggets along related themes. Over the next few days, we'll share some nuggets on breathing life into work so that you can follow up on this podcast episode. If you wish to receive this communication, you just have to do a couple of things. One, note down this number, +91 85914 52129. I repeat, it's +91 85914 52129. Add this to your contacts in your phone book and just send a WhatsApp message to this number saying interested, and we'll ensure we add you to our list. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations of this podcast. Bye now.